I'm Ryan Miller, Crops Extension Educator. Earlier this morning, we recorded an episode of the Strategic Farming Field Notes program. Strategic Farming Field Notes is a weekly program addressing current crop production topics. A live webinar is hosted at 8 a.m. on Wednesdays throughout the cropping season. During the live webinar, participants can join in the discussion and get questions answered. An audio recording of the live program is released following the webinar via podcast platforms. Thanks, and remember to tune in weekly for a discussion on current cropping and crop management topics.
Welcome to today's Strategic Farming Field Notes program, focusing on insect updates and management considerations. These sessions are brought to you with generous support by the Soybean Research and Promotion Council and the Corn Research and Promotion Council. And we're happy you joined us for today's session. My name is Claire LeCan. I'm an extension educator in crops out of the Andover Regional Office. And we welcome Bob Cook, who's our extension soybean entomologist, Dr. Fei Yang, too, our extension corn entomologist, and Bruce Potter, who's our extension integrated pest management specialist. So with that, I'll kick us off here by asking the three of you, just to kind of give us a quick overview of maybe the effects of our warm, moderate temperatures this winter, kind of the effects that the current rain situation in many parts of the state might be having, and kind of just a quick overview of what's going on in relation to insects and the state of affairs across the state.
Hey, Claire, maybe I can take a stab at this first, and then Bruce and Faye can chime in. Insects are affected differently by different weather conditions and things happening at different times of the year. If we think back to the winter, it was pretty mild overall. So that probably helped a lot of insects that spend the winter here fare better or survive at higher rates. But then this spring, as we know, we've had some pretty severe storms, lots of rain, and that can have a couple different effects, right? As these weather patterns line up, sometimes that can help the migration of some of the migratory insects moving from the south to the north. But then also all these hard rains and cooling water can certainly take a toll on, maybe survival of some insects that live in the soil, or pests like the soybean aphid that are trying to move from buckthorn to small soybean plants. All that rain can reduce their survival and their ability to establish colonies on the soybean plants. So for soybean aphid in particular, I think they probably did well over the winter, but like I was saying, I think in areas where we had real heavy rains, which was a lot of areas, it probably decreased their survival on these small soybean plants. But soybean aphids have a real high reproductive potential, lots of generations, so there is still potential that they could bounce back even if they were set back. So, I kind of go to the default response where we need to be scouting. Some of the fields I'm seeing in Southeast Minnesota, we certainly have aphids there. I suspect we do in a lot of other areas. And, what's a little concerning to me is in some of these fields, there's already a high percentage of the plants that are infested with soybean aphid. And it seems like as we get more plants in a field infested, then they're, after a while, their ability to increase in numbers really increases. I'll let Bruce or Faye, chime in on corn or some other aspects of how weather, might be affecting some of these different insects.
Yeah, for corn rootworm, we have a very warm winter this year. So the eggs probably, they have good, very good survival during the winter. And this will help build up the population of corn rootworm populations. So if you plant earlier, May or late April, I think that's the first planting window time. And probably you will have some good, heavy infestation of the rootworms. But as mentioned, the weather right now, you have a lot of rain. So a lot of the corn or the soil was saturated. So lots of water over there. And this will help bring down some populations of the rootworm. But I think the damage is already over there, so we still have like a severe damage. And we test some field trials around the campus, and we check some plants, and we found like a severe damage of the cone roots by the cone root wall. So in general, we have some good winter weather to support the survival of the rootworms, and we have recently we have too much rain to kill some probably the egg and also the larvae, but the overall population for rootworm is still over there.
Yeah, thanks for that, Faye. And Bruce, you are in a particularly wet part of the state over southwestern Minnesota. So you mentioned you've been seeing some probable corn rootworm drowning and.
You know, over the last week, I took a tour through a lot of Minnesota. I got over as far as Waseca and all the way through southwest Minnesota, southern central, west central Minnesota. And it's wet all over. And in some areas, it's you know, pretty distressing. We've got a lot of drowned outs and stunted corn. And, you know, if like Faye was mentioning, if the corn plants are dead, the rootworms on them, if they died reasonably early, those rootworms are dead as well. If they're submerged for 24 hours or more, you know, the warmer it is, the shorter they can survive. We're going to have, they're going to drown. They build up lactic acid and drown. But Bob mentioned something too about, you know, migratory insects coming in and what kind of weather we have once they arrive. We had huge, and we talked about this earlier in the year, huge black cutworm flights come in, bigger than we've had in many years, but the damage wasn't as significant as I expected. And I think one of the reasons for that is those moths tend to lay their eggs in depressional areas, and a lot of those went underwater, particularly in the areas where we had those heavy flights. So we kind of survived a bullet there. I think we've got soybean aphids here, but they're on little islands where the soybeans have not been sitting in water for a long period of time, better growth. And then the only thing that kind of matched what we expected as far as overwintering so far has been alfalfa weevil, so it seemed to do just fine.
Yeah, we had some significant infestations of those across the state, didn't we, on the alfalfa weevil side? And you monitor for armyworm too, Bruce. What have you seen? What do you have to share with us?
Well, the traps have been pretty low, with the exception of some traps up in Roseau County. But yesterday I got some reports in from northern, west central, southern into the valley, where we've got some pretty bad armyworm damage in a few wheat fields. So those kind of snuck around the traps. But, you know, basically this time of year, if you've got wheat or if you've had corn planted into a rye cover crop, it's probably a good idea to be checking for that insect.
Yeah, Bruce, like in the early season, we did some seed corn maggots, like trials, and we see like a little bit, like we cannot say high, like a moderate infestation in some of our field trials.
Yeah, it was a good year for seed corn maggots and planting dates and fly activity kind of matched up in a lot of cases. And they were getting around some of the seed treatments as well. So I think part of that too is, you know, just so much water that, you know, we moved that active ingredient away from where the feeding was happening.
Yeah, we did several trials. So for our first trial, we see like a moderate infestation, but for the second and third late planting trial, we didn't see too much infestation.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you, just to remind everybody here, like what do you do to a corn maggot?
What was the question, Claire?
Oh, just how can people manage seed corn maggot at this point?
So what we did here, like we did lots of like seed treatments, use like a neonicotinoid insecticides. So that provided very good control for these seed corn maggots if the population is not very high.
Neonicotinoids did a yep. Seed treatment? Okay.
The other thing too is kind of watching and those models are on the extension or on the university website, and kind of looking for when those flies are active. And then you're at high risk if you're planting into something that's been manured or green manured or during that period. And it's kind of a just moving your planting date around a few days can make a big difference, like Faye was mentioning.
Yeah, based on like a different planting dates, we see different like infestation levels.
So Claire, so there's not too much you can do after you discover infestation, right? So it's thinking about the risk of particular fields, you know, different things that might make that field attractive. As Bruce mentioned, the degree day models for timing planting, and then different preventative insecticide applications like the seed treatments.
And it's a good reminder that we have those degree day models available online and some forecasting tools at the university to take a look at those. So, yeah, well, going back to corn rootworm, Faye and Bruce too, we had a question coming before our episode here today from an email wondering about just the observations of corn rootworm feeding across the state. Do you have any updates on that? You mentioned your trials. Bruce mentioned, you know, some of the drowning, but what are you seeing feeding wise?
Well, it's out there, but I think right now, you know, we're getting close to the time where we can kind of gauge how bad that damage is going to be. We've still got larvae out there. We've still got some root feeding. But I mean, if guys wanted to start getting a handle on things, you know, they could do some root digs and some root floats and see what kind of larvae are out there and what kind of damage we got. But that damage is, I would expect it to continue to increase for a little while.
Yeah, because most of the egg should hatch like in June. So they will feed on the roots for about like 4 to 8 weeks. Right now, probably it's laying stuff because like a rootworm egg, they will experience like 3 different instars. Probably right now it's a 30 instar. And you will see probably in 1 or 2 weeks, a lot of beetle is emerging in your fields. So as Bruce said, the best option is to dig your roots and rate your damage. And then you can see, well, how about your like management strategies, how it works this year for this season. And also later, and then you can put some yellow stick traps. And also you can use like whole plant sampling for your beetles. So you can predict the populations next year and to see what kind of management strategies you can use for the future. You can use different insecticides, seed treatments, and also you can choose like different BT traits based on your field history. And also like a rootworm is very like local. So fields like even very close, so they are totally different. So you need to manage like determine your management strategies totally based on your field characteristics.
I think the important thing to know about, remember about corn rootworms is right now, unless you're in a rare situation where you've got, you know, pre-pollination silk clipping, which is actually pretty rare, you know, right now we're managing for next year for rootworms. I mean, all our options for this year are over, and we're looking at how well what we did worked and what, as Faye mentioned, what to do for next year.
Yeah, that's a good reminder.
Revenge is fun, but it's pretty expensive.
Yeah, it's $1 billion. It's $1 billion back. So it costs lots of damage and also lots of cost for management. And because like a rootworm, it seems like it can overcome every like a management strategy. It's developing resistance to culture practice, insecticides, BT traits.
Yeah, we had a question about insecticide resistance in corn rootworm too, Faye. So do you have any resources or tools you want to point people toward maybe for looking at what treatments are still effective, which BT traits are still considered effective?
So in Minnesota, we have two different species of rootworm. One is like a Western corn rootworm and one is Northern corn rootworm. So the Western corn rootworm, it seems it developed resistance to almost every strategies for insecticides, parasitoids, and BT traits, CRI3BB1, CRI34CertifiedAB1, But the only thing we have right now, maybe working for Western cone rootworm, is RNA technology. That's new. But with all the BT traits, like it is out of efficacy, so that we put RNA as a single trait. So if the insect pressure is high, it can develop resistance very fast to RNA for Western cone rootworm. And also for Northern cone rootworm, the resistance, it seems not that widespread like in the state. But we had, I think they published a paper late last year, and they found some cases for Northern cone rootworm developing resistance in Minnesota in Meeker County to Chrysler BB1 and the Chrysler 4-sulfide AB1. That's the first report for Northern cone rootworm developing resistance within the state. And except for that, I think like several years ago, they found like a field population showing resistance in our neighboring like state, like North Dakota, and they reported like unexpected survival of the Northern cone rootworm to Chrysler BB1 and Chrysler 4-sulfide AB1 BT traits. So right now the population of Northern is increasing, and with the development resistance to both CRY-3BB1 and CRY-4-sulfide AB1 BT proteins, that means we need to pay attention. So we need to sample some beetles this year, and we can test the survivability like across the state to these BT proteins to get a general idea about the population like status against the BT traits. Do you have anything to add, Bruce?
Well, I mean, as far as insecticide resistance, you know, I don't think there's been anything documented in Minnesota, but for guys that have been doing a lot of beetle bombing, trying to control adults, I'd be a little suspicious, because there is resistance to beetles just over as close as Nebraska to a lot of different foliar compounds, including the pyrethroids. So think about rootworms. If you do things often enough to them, they'll develop resistance, and it doesn't take very long. I think we're seeing BT resistance. It's been always about 4 or 5 crops, and they seem to, enough of them seem to get around the trait to cause problems.
Yeah, another thing I want to add, like, is not resistance, and we did some like competition studies between Western and the Northern cone rootworm, like in the greenhouse settings. And we did 2 trials, and it experienced like almost like 1 year. So each experiment takes about like 4 months. And we found the results were very consistent, and the Western cone rootworm is more competitive compared to the like Northern cone rootworm. So with the so only difference is like the Northern cone rootworm, they have like a more competitive to like a cold tolerance compared to Western cone rootworm. However, if like last year and maybe future like a global warming or climate change, and if the temperature is okay, so Western cone rootworm, they may expand the population to the north, and that will increase the challenge for rootworm management, because as we mentioned before, Western cone rootworm develop resistance almost to every BT traits.
And no, it's not great news, but Bruce, you have a tool that I've seen you share a lot that called the Handy BT Trait Table. So we can maybe plug that into our resource sheet to share with listeners too.
Yeah, it's a good tool. And you know, I mentioned armyworms briefly, and in corn, there's basically only one of the BT traits, the VIP3A or Viptera trait that's effective on true armyworms. So that table's real handy, and it's also got a list of attached to it, a list of known resistance issues. So it's pretty good. It's a pretty good resource. I can't keep them straight, probably because of my advanced age, but I can't keep the thing straight. And I use that resource all the time.
That's put together by Chris DeFonso, right? At Michigan, and someone from Texas.
And Pat Porter. Yeah. Chris and Pat, but mostly Chris.
I won't comment on the age, but I use it a lot too, Bruce. this is kind of changing gears a little bit, but we can address some of the questions that came in on email. There were questions kind of around cover crops and insect interactions. And so there was a question specifically asking, do cover crops help break pest cycles in a corn and soybean rotation? Bruce is shaking his head.
I think I agree with Bruce shaking his head there. I don't think, I'm not aware of any situations where we could probably break a pest cycle in Minnesota. There's some data where, like in soybean, for example, you know, we've seen where if you plant soybean into say a rye cover crop, you might end up with less soybean aphids in that soybean that's growing with the cover crop than in soybean without. But, you know, you've got other issues there too with the two crops potentially competing, you know, if the cover crop isn't terminated at the right time. So there's a chance where you could get a benefit, but having these cover crops in the system, it, you know, provides all the other benefits that people know about, but it does create some situations where pest risk is increased. And Bruce mentioned that, you know, if you're planting corn into a grass cover crop or something to that effect, I think the risk is highest, you know, as that main cash crop and the cover crop, the more closely related those are, right? So corn and some of these small grains, they're pretty closely related. You get some of the same pests can feed on both of them. So I think there's higher risk there. This year, I saw a situation where a farmer had some alfalfa mixed in with a cover crop and was going to put it into pasture, but at the last minute decided to put soybean in that field. And there is a pretty huge infestation of alfalfa weevil on that alfalfa before planting the soybean. And after terminating the alfalfa, those alfalfa weevils moved over to the soybean and were actually doing quite a bit of feeding there. And I had never seen that before and haven't really seen that reported in the literature other than, you know, a couple like laboratory studies saying it's possible. But again, you know, alfalfa and soybean are fairly closely related, so it's not a huge surprise that you can get some of those pests moving over.
And so it's just one, I think the best way to look at this is the only way to break a pest, you know, overwintering pests in a crop is to not grow the host. And with the cover crop, you still have the host in the host plant in the field, whether it's corn, soybeans, or whatever. So you're not really giving the field a break from that host crop. So you're not going to solve a rootworm problem, for example, doing that.
It's not a true crop rotation, right, Bruce?
Right.
Kind of a follow-up to that, there was an email asking, has there been an increase in insect concerns from growing cover crops? And I think, you know, you kind of touched on it, Bob, that if you're growing kind of similar or kind of same plant family ahead of your cash crop, right, a rye cover crop ahead of corn or an alfalfa ahead of soybean, there's probably increased reason to scout, right, or to probably increased management. And maybe just in general with cover crops, we know there's increased management and probably prompting to scout more. Like we know, Bruce, with armyworm being probably the eggs are laid in a rye cover crop or grassy cover crop or even grass weeds in the field, and then they'll feed on corn after that.
You've personally seen the impressive results of that, haven't you? Yeah.
Yeah, yes. Those like a cover crop will attract a lot of migrate, like a black cutworm, true armyworm, and for armyworm, it depends. So to those like a cover crop, and so the timing for the termination is very important. So if you terminate like earlier and you late plant for the spring planting, maybe you can kill the population.
Yeah.
And there I guess you. Go ahead, Bruce.
I was going to say there's two ways to get armyworms into corn, and one is to have a bunch of uncontrolled heavy infestation of uncontrolled grassy weeds, and the other way is to plant an uncontrolled infestation of grassy weeds as a cover crop. So
yeah,
but you know, even though we're saying all this, there's no guarantee that using a cover crop,
yes,
there's no guarantee that it will cause a problem, right? It just increases the risk. And as Claire mentioned, you know, I totally agree that what we should do then is be scouting that field, you know, paying attention, you know, to these potential pests, and I think, Bruce, I've seen in some of your slides, and I can't keep track of all the traits and stuff, but for some of these pests, you know, if you're concerned about corn, for example, you might consider certain traits or something that might be more effective against some of these other caterpillar pests that might be more likely in that scenario.
Yeah, I would plant something with that VIP3A if I was planting corn into rye, especially if I wasn't going to get the rye terminated real early.
And there's some literature out there, and I think, Bob, you've done some studies too, kind of looking at presence and effectiveness of like natural enemies too when you have a cover crop, that maybe there is some correlation, some attractiveness of cover crops for getting those beneficial insects in your fields too. But time flies when we're talking insects. So I have a couple more questions I want to make sure we get to. Any emerging technologies that are showing promise that came in from an email?
Hey, you want to talk about the new traits?
Yeah, so one thing like for the current commercialized management for rootworm is RNI technology. So this technology is not used alone. It's we call it like a pyrimidine with other BD traits, with the cholesterol BB1, and that's VT4 Pro. And also we have like SmartStack Pro. The RNI technology is used with together with like a cholesterol BB1 and the cholesterol 30-surf.
Cool. Hey, I think you muted yourself.
Muted.
Oh, sorry. So the RNI technology is used with the cholesterol BB1, cholesterol 30-surf BB1, these BD proteins. They can help like provide multiple like mode of actions to control like a rootworm. So that's a new technology. And also there are several technology underway. So like several technology from Bayer and from Corteva with like Cry75AA and also VIP4 and also IPD. I've got the serial number. So those IPD is from Corteva. So those two technologies is under registration. So maybe they can bring some new model of actions for management of rootworm in the future. And also a new stuff like I'm working on right now, because like we try to see whether silicon rocks, those are used to capture like carbon dioxide. So those can increase boost the plant health. And also because like, you know, like rootworm larvae is attracted based on CO2 released by the root. But those silicon rocks can absorb the CO2, and this may disrupt the behavior of the rootworm larvae to target the roots. And also, as I mentioned, those silicon rocks can boost the plant health. They can make the plant to be more tolerant to the damage. So maybe they can provide some protection for the yield. So we are working on these right now. So these are some new information, new technologies in the future.
Thanks, Faye. We'll stay tuned for that. And one question we got in email that caused all of us to kind of do some looking and researching prior to the program is, can chlorpyrifos be used to control red sunflower seed weevil and sunflowers in Minnesota? And we think partially why this question is coming up is because of the status of chlorpyrifos, where it was revoked by EPA for a while. There's kind of temporary use allowed for certain products back in Minnesota. So right now there's four products that are allowed in Minnesota, two that are foliar products. And we can kind of share information. I put some of that information in the resource sheet, but the short answer is no, those products aren't currently usable in sunflowers, right? Bob and Bruce, do you want to kind of touch on which crops are going to be allowed for chlorpyrifos moving forward, or at least the best current news we have now on that, at least?
Yeah. So again, I don't think we have the perfect understanding yet, and we're going to reach out to our colleagues at the Department of Agriculture to, you know, maybe put out a crop news to clarify some of this. But it sounds like toward the end of June, there was an EPA announcement that came out potentially reducing the number of crops on which these chlorpyrifos products can be used, and what was it, narrowed down to 11 different crops. I don't have that list in front of me, but it, from what we can tell, it looks like sunflower was removed from that list, but I think things like alfalfa and soybean and maybe wheat still remain for Minnesota. Is that right, Bruce?
Yep, and sugar beets. And then some vegetable crops and fruit crops.
But we're going to, like I said, get in contact with the folks at the MDA and try to get some better clarification here and get that out on crop news so everybody has the most accurate, up-to-date information on what they can or can't do.
Yep, on which crops it's usable on, which, again, which products, and then what pests they're labeled for is all good information to know. And I think you're saying too, Bob, if people really question, they can also check directly with Minnesota Department of Agriculture, you know, before they make an application too. So, well, we're at the end of our program. Any parting thoughts from anyone? You do have a bug joke or anything, Bruce? You're usually good for something like that.
No, I don't know. It's I was in a better mood. We kind of missed a lot of the rain here at Lamberton, but that changed this morning. So my plans for the day are completely different. It's, you know, I think we drowned some more rootworms if anything's come out of the roots to pupate or to molt or something like that. So I guess that's positive.
Yeah, there we go. All right. Well, thanks again for being here today. And we appreciate your insights and discussion. And thanks, everybody, for attending the program. Again, we want to thank our sponsors, the Minnesota Soybean Research and Promotion Council and the Minnesota Corn Research and Promotion Council.